You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Schichter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And even though it's been raining a little bit, it was beautiful sunny this morning when we're recording. But Don, what was the temperature last night?
Did I send you that little note yesterday morning? Okay, backing up. We should do this at the start of each show. Today's date is March 27th. 2024. Lois and I are recording Davis Garden Show for broadcast on KDRT March 28th, 2024. Monday, the 26th, the low temperature in Dixon was 39 degrees.
39 degrees.
And that prompted some conversation when I took a screenshot of that and posted that on my personal Facebook page. The first comment from someone was, "Oh, too early for tomatoes." Ha ha ha. Which is actually true. Yes. But the next question, we'll get back to the weather in a moment, was my tomatoes are already in the ground. What should I do?
What you should have done a few days ago.
That's a different conversation. What you should have done, but what should she do now that they're already planted? And I've got customers and friends who plant in March. One of them always plants on March 17th. We're in the ground. He took pictures of them a few days ago. And the answer is, well, there's really nothing to be done. I will say that another fellow nursery person said, dig them back up, put them back in pots and bring them closer. Is not an unreasonable consideration considering what we're about to get to in the weather. No, there's not a frost risk, but the plants are not going to be happy being in soil that's that cold. If they're in a raised bed, soil will be a little bit warmer. She was wondering if she should cover them. Okay, well, the daytime highs matter somewhat, just as the nighttime lows matter. So we were upper 60s, around 70 a couple days ago. That's good. But here's the weather for this coming week. Right now, it's 54 degrees and partly cloudy. Wednesday, there's going to be some chance of There's some chance of showers today and tonight especially. So with the cloud cover, we're only going to get down to about 45, which is colder than we like for tomatoes, especially colder than we like for peppers and eggplant. Thursday, mostly sunny, but only getting up to 60 degrees. Thursday night, mostly cloudy, 44 degrees again. We do have another storm coming this way. Looks like it's mostly aiming southern part of the state, but we will have a chance of showers Friday, 50% chance of showers, and the high will only be 58. Remember, our rule of thumb is we like the low to be 55 minimum, and the high is going to be 58. So showers are likely Friday night, a low of 46. Saturday, showers likely. Unfortunately, busy gardening day for a lot of people. Well, it's going to be showery, not pouring, but still only 60 degrees. Saturday night, chance of showers and mostly cloudy. With the cloud cover again, we're going to stay around 45 degrees. Easter Sunday, mostly sunny, 63 degrees. And Sunday night, mostly clear, so about 44 degrees. And then a warming trend for the mid part of next week. Monday going to be sunny with a high near 69, but Monday night clear, still dropping down to about 46. And Tuesday and Wednesday sunny with a high near 73. So what to do about the tomatoes you stuck in the ground? Cross your fingers. I don't have another answer for you. This is why we emphasize over and over again to not plant early. What is going to happen is you're going to see some effect on the roots. The soil is cold. They're going to have difficulty taking up nutrients. They're cold. The air is cold, so they'll have difficulty moving the mobile nutrients that are in the plant. So you will see apparent nutrient deficiencies, such as phosphorus deficiency because of the root injury from cold soil. The plants will turn kind of purplish. Nitrogen deficiency within the plant, the new growth will look a little bit yellow and perhaps anemic. Feeding won't make any difference because it isn't that the nutrients aren't there, it's that the nutrients can't be taken up or taken in by the plant. So you just wait, and you wait until things warm up. And the good news about tomatoes is that even though they're subtropical plants, they're pretty vigorous. Once the soil does get warm enough, your plants will start to grow. The thing is, you haven't gained anything by early planting. And the night temperatures we're looking at for the next few days are not going to be helping any of this. And the daytime highs are not going to be helping with any of this. Putting a little greenhouse thing over them, that won't make that much difference to the soil temperature. So you just wait and you see. What I would do, if I had already planted some tomatoes, is I'd go to a really good local garden center in about four weeks and buy exact replicas of those varieties and plant another bed with them. And then monitor.
And then you'll see what happens.
As the season goes along, count the fruit, take a picture of the plants in about August, send it to us, and we can see if early planting was beneficial, harmful, or made no difference at all. Because I'd be very curious about that. I've done that in a very rudimentary way over the years. I've always found early planting of tomatoes makes no beneficial difference. Sometimes it's harmful. Really, the early planting that is harmful is peppers and eggplant, and for that matter, watermelon and okra, which really need warm soil. So if you stuck your tomatoes in, it's not the end of the world, but I think you're beginning to see why we don't actually recommend that. However,
you still have time to go to your friendly local nursery and find some varieties that you hadn't planted yet. So try some experimental things, you know.
Yeah, there you go. Try some other things. I mean, Wild Boar Farms, which is a local grower breeder that introduced all those fascinating open pollinated tomatoes, he'll be delivering to local garden centers, including ours, but several others around the area, in early April. So he hasn't even got his stuff out there yet. So one thing I run into, it seems like, why is it older guys? What is it about these older guys? Look, I'm one of you now.
They're set in their ways, Don.
You can't argue with me. I'm in your category now. So I'm an older guy. I'm going to push back on it.
And you're set in your ways, too.
That's right. Well, one of the things is they seem to think we're going to run out. You know, someone literally said over a week ago, so did I miss the tomato season?
What?
And if you want to hear that thumping noise over in the sound of the garden center, it's me pounding my head on my desk. No, you did not miss it. There'll be plenty. Don't worry, folks. But anyway, I think we beat this subject into the ground, but then we get these results. So we're going into a warming trend next week. What?
Speaking of beating things into the ground, we had a really strong rain a while ago. Is that the last one for the season, you think?
No. It looks like long range forecasts is we may get back into a wet pattern after this nice week of warmer weather that's upcoming. So we could have a colder, wetter spell again, looking about the second week of April. Those long term models, of course, are dicier, but that's what it looks like. We may be going back into a rainy pattern. We do want to remind you that KDRT is community radio, which means public radio, which means we rely on contributions from listeners like all of you to fund our operating costs. If you like the Davis Garden Show or all the other great programming here at KDRT, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. There's all kinds of great programming there, and Lois and I collaborated on one that's upcoming. Lois?
Well, my show is called That's Life, and it is broadcast just before the Davis Garden Show, Thursdays at 11, for the time being, though that
may change. For now.
Yes. I think it's going to change this quarter. But anyway, so I have not been doing much broadcasting, but Don and I recorded, and it's going to be on not the 28th, but the week after that. I believe that's April 4th. So if you want to hear that live, well, it's not really live. Everything is pre-recorded at this point. But the broadcast for the first time, 11 a.m. Thursday,
April 4th. Yes. And what did we talk about?
Well, we talked about Don. No. We talked about jazz. That's what we
talked about. Talk about jazz, because I do a show called Jazz After Dark. But what we really talked about actually was the other genres of music that relate to jazz.
Yeah.
It was fun. We went all over the place. So it's a fun exploration of the inside of my brain.
And boy, I got to tell you, that is an interesting place to be.
It's a dangerous place to be, yes. Okay. One thing I want to mention real quickly, we mentioned it last week, but for those of you that like to go to the Arboretum sales and are so used to going on Saturday mornings, the next one's on a Sunday. Okay. If you go over there Saturday, April 6th, you can wander around the Arboretum. You will be alone. If you go there Sunday, April 7th, that's when they're having the next Arboretum sale. It's the first they've done. As far as I know, it's the first they've ever done on a Sunday. First hour is members only, 9 to 10 a.m. Then the public sale is 10 to 1 p.m. You can join at the door or online or something. Yeah, you can do all of the above, actually. So it's Sunday, April 7th. If that's not convenient for you, the next one is Saturday, April 27th.
I have an email from one of our listeners, Mary Oliva or Oliva. I'm not sure how that is pronounced.
Oliva, probably. Yep.
And, you know, usually we don't say last names on the air just for privacy, but she is actually a volunteer with the Sacramento Valley chapter of the California Native Plant Society. And so she sent us an announcement, which I will read, and she sent some flyers for us, too. So I'm an avid listener of the show and also a volunteer for the California Native Plant Society. We are having a yearly garden tour that includes locations in Yolo County, chiefly Davis and Woodland, and in the greater Sacramento area. I'm reaching out in the hopes that it is something you would be interested in mentioning on the show. This year's Gardens Gone Native Tour will be held on April 27th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. I've attached our official press release, which has more detailed description and details of the free registration, which is necessary to receive the map and tour brochure for the gardens. I've also included a copy of our flyer and a digital version of that. She dropped some off with Don at the.
Yep.
Okay, so.
SacValleyCNPS.org. If you have trouble remembering SacValleyCNPS.org, you can just type in Sacramento Valley California Native Plant Society and it'll get you there. It's a great tour.
I went to their front page of their homepage. It's not at the top. You have to scroll all the way to the bottom. And then you get to something that you can click on that which takes you to something which doesn't. Anyway, I'm going to read the press release because it's a lovely press release. And y'all should hear this. Gardens Gone Native, a plant tour on April 27th, 2024 from 9:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. The Gardens Gone Native Plant Tour is a free garden tour featuring 30 or more California native plant home and school gardens in the Sacramento region. Gardens are comprised predominantly of California native plants in the urban landscape. These gardens feature a variety of ways in which native plants can flourish in the home garden. Some are professionally designed, while others are more functional and are a mixed use of natives, food production, and living spaces. You will find delightful and sustainable gardens that harness water, create habitats, and add a sense of place. Attendees will have the opportunity to ask garden hosts about their choices and challenges. After registration, you will receive the map and tour brochure information the week before the tour begins. I've been on one of these and they are amazing. Make absolutely sure you take your map with you because sometimes it's a little hard to get from point A to point B.
Okay.
Anyway, registration is there if you go to the website. And I think, Don, don't you have it in your store too? They can.
Yes, we do have emails there.
It's one of those things where you can point your phone at this little funny little symbol and.
It's called a QR code, Lois.
Oh, yeah.
I want to mention Mary's comment here because this is accurate and I think it's great point. Several weeks ago, Don mentioned that Ceanothus is often short-lived in the area and specified that they aren't locally native. However, there is a species, Ceanothus cuneatus, whose historic native range includes woodland riparian areas in Sacramento and Yolo counties. Well, I cannot, she says, yet comment on its longevity in the garden. It is locally native. I must note that it has white flowers, unlike most of the commercially available Ceanothus, and it may have more variation in habit and inflorescence due to being the straight species, not a cultivar. And that's a great comment. It is actually true. We have a native species in the valley. Most of the native species of Ceanothus are in the bathtub ring around the valley, as we call it. If you like what I mean by that, calscape.org is an incredibly valuable resource. And you go there and you type in a plant or you type in a location, and it'll show you plants for your location or where a particular plant is native. You'll even show occurrences that they're using for that data. And a whole lot of the Ceanothus are Foothill Sierra, Foothill Coast Range, East Side or West Side, or of course Southern California Chaparral. Almost all of the Ceanothus that are popular in the nursery industry and with consumers are not from the valley. Cuneatus is, as she notes, it is a white flower. I just did a search. I've backed up every availability list from all of my growers that I've saved in the last 4 years onto this computer. So I can do a search to see if any of them have ever had a particular plant in the last 4 years. And the answer is zero. Of the wholesale growers that I work with have had Ceanothus cuneatus on their list at all in that entire time, including native plant growers, with one exception. Poudre Creek Council, who we're working with now at our nursery, buying plants from, is apparently growing that particular one. All the rest of the growers that I work with grow the, what I call the gourmet varieties, the ones that everybody knows, the popular varieties, which are blue and purple. That's the color people want. And so all those ones you see, Concha, Yankee Point, Dark Star, Julia Phelps, Ray Hartman, none of those are native in the valley or any place as hot here, or, well, I won't say that, but as, with soils as dense and all the different problems that we have. But this one, Buckbrush, is indeed native throughout much of our region, or was native, I should say, before it was all converted to agriculture throughout much of our region. So if you want a truly native ceanothus and you're listening in this area, look around. You might have to go to a CNPS sale to find Ceanothus cuneatus. Miriday Nursery might grow it. They do show up at some of those sales with their pop-up nursery. And as I say, I found it on one list, so there's a possible chance that for the first time in history, I might actually have it at my garden center, more likely in the fall than in the spring. But be advised in advance, it's white, and that's not the color, honestly, that most people are looking for. I would imagine, though, it's probably tougher. And I'm guessing, because of its native range, probably longer lived than the ones that you all have been planting. My experience with Ceanothus, that of my customers in general, they grow great in this area. That's the problem. They grow really, really well. They grow very fast. I got 7 years out of a Dark Star Ceanothus, which is one of the most beautiful cobalt blue flowered ones you'll ever see. Grew very rapidly to about 8 by 8, or broader actually than tall. Vivid bloom, and then 7th or 8th year in, as often happens, just abruptly died from Phytophthora. I wasn't changing the irrigation. We just had late rains that season. People who plant Ray Hartman, because it's listed as a tree. It's on a lot of tree lists because it's one of the upright growing Ceanothus. It gets big, 15 feet plus. Planted one from a 1 gallon. It was 10 feet tall by the end of the second growing season. Third year, it bloomed beautifully in the spring, curled up its toes and died clearly from Phytophthora. And I had backed off on the irrigation on that one as well. It's not from an interior parentage, so it doesn't surprise me that it wouldn't be as happy here in the hot climate that we have. And generally, they're from places with poor soils with slopes, and we have good soils and no slopes. So we have some challenges growing them here. They grow great. They just tend to fall apart or die pretty quickly. But if you can back off on your irrigation, I mean, I know there are people out there who have established Ceanothus that are more than 5 years old. If you can back off on the irrigation pretty quickly, as fast as you can, and you can make sure that water doesn't stand around that tree during or bush during high rainfall periods. People are thinking, well, rainfall is in the winter. Yeah, but we have years like 2017, 2019, where it rained all the way into early May, and then it got hot. That's the problem. It isn't the irrigation in a year like that. It's the rainfall. The soil is still moist when the temperature goes up. Phytophthora has its inoculation and infection conditions that are optimal, and the plant gets attacked and dies. And that does happen here. We have as many flood years as drought years as we do in the Sacramento Valley, and that can be a problem. But if you've elevated it, put it up on a mound, put it on a slope that in our area you literally have created, because we basically don't have any slopes here, pretty good chance of getting it past an event like that. So usually the problem is irrigation, because people are planting them into irrigated landscapes. If you can put them in a gradually unirrigated landscape, maybe just occasional deep watering during the summer or overhead sprinkling to wash off the foliage, occasional meaning like once a month, you may get longer life out of them. Just as with manzanitas, you can find the right place, the right conditions, and you can get it past that difficult challenge of moist soil going into warm weather, which leads to Phytophthora crown rot.
So he's talking about that specific species.
All of them. Yeah. There are exceptions.
No, Don, when you were talking about this lovely plant that's a possibility you might be able to get.
Cuneatus, yes. Okay.
And he said the word buckbrush. Now, understand, buckbrush is a common term, and it may apply to different things in different places with different people. So be careful to specify the species.
Ceanothus cuneatus.
Be specific.
Cuneatus. I'm going to say this, it's kind of rangy looking plant, so it would go better in a mixed native planting. My solution to the problem with Ceanothus here in our area is be sure to buy a toyon when you buy your Ceanothus. Because right about the time the Ceanothus is finished giving you that glorious 3, 4, 5, 7 years, whatever it is, and it's beginning to fall apart or die, your toyon will be getting fully established and beautiful. And it seems to be quite a tough plant.
And it gets bigger. I mean, yes. When you first start, you think, oh, it's a nice plant. And then one year it just goes, oh, woof.
I've been surprised.
Twice as big as it was.
I've been surprised how fast Toyon grows. It's not as fast as Photinia, to which it's closely related, but it's comparable in terms of giving you privacy screens. So those of you who are looking for a hedge, I know I tout Toyon all the time, but I might as well throw this in there because it does not seem to have the Phytophthora susceptibility that other natives have. It'll grow, mine grew 3 feet a year, definitely, and that was with just deep, infrequent watering. And there are big Toyons around. I mean, there's on the corner of L and 8th in Davis, there is one that's at least 15 feet tall. People ask me about it all the time because it happens to be one of the ones with the golden berries. Mostly they're red berries. It's turning into a tree. So if your hedge choices at your local garden center have leaned towards Xylosma and Photinia and you want a native, anywhere I can think of in the lowland parts of California, Toyon would be a good option as well. So anyway, that was a digression, but thank you for the email. And I hope a lot of people head out and get some great ideas from these native plant gardens.
And Mary ends her email with, I really appreciate having the expertise and experience of someone who has gardened in the area for such a long time. I've managed to resist sowing watermelon too early this year, which is a big accomplishment on my end.
Yeah, watermelon really needs warm soil. There are a few things I don't plant till after Memorial Day weekend, and watermelons are in that category. Also, for those of you that have never grown them, It takes a lot of space. I've decided to give a planting of 2 pots. I sell them in little 3-inch pots of watermelon in one hill, sort of a hill. Measure exactly how much space they actually needed and what the yield was. And it was one of the new varieties, like Crimson Sweet, I'm pretty sure. Very good one for this area. They needed a 6x6 area, right? 6x6, and I got 2 watermelons off of each planting. So 4 watermelons total from a 6x6 area. Each of those watermelons was about 8 to 10 pounds. And so that was great. And of course, they all ripened the same week. So that's one of the problems with watermelon. So I didn't plant them until the first week of June. I was harvesting them 85, 90 days later, and they were great. But just so you know, they cannot have any competition. Can't have anything taller shading them. They need to be full sun. It's a fairly low profile plant. So if you have pumpkins or other squash commingling with them, it'll shade them out because those are all taller. They need their own dedicated space, about a 6x6 area was what most of the vine took. Yes, they ran past that, but you can, you know, take those runners and fling them back onto the main part of the planting if you want to. But that's what you need to donate or devote in your garden to watermelon production if you want to grow. 6x6 area gives you 3 to 4 watermelons. Sugar Baby is a better choice for a lot of home gardeners because it is a smaller plant, hence the name, and a smaller watermelon. It's about a 6 or 8 pound watermelon, which is a good size for a lot of folks. A 10 or 12 pound watermelon is a big thing to consume. It's party food because they don't keep that well. But I've often wondered exactly how much room you need to devote to these things. So I'm trying to measure this 6x6 roughly for a couple watermelon plants. Also, I will say the modern hybrids are way better than the heirloom varieties. This is one case where breeding has led to a much better home garden product. And the third bit of advice, the day you plant them, look at the label, look at the number of days on the label, take whatever calendar you like to use, whether it's on your phone or some kind of garden journal. If it says 87 days, go 87 days further into your calendar and mark that date, check watermelons for harvest, because they'll look ripe 2 weeks before then. Mm-hmm. I know this because that's when my son would always pick them when he was a little boy. He would bring them into the house and I go, oh, we learned a lesson again, didn't we? They're not ripe yet. So mark your calendar when you plant them. Okay.
All right. Going back to our mail. And if you want to send us a message, you can send it to
davisgardenshow@gmail.com.
All right. So Annie from San Rafael, who we read one of her messages last week or the week before, something like that. Hi, Don and Lois. Thank you ever so much for your fabulous slug and snail advice. As you can see, the cheapest beer I could find, which was a light beer, managed to murder dozens of slugs in just 2 nights.
Fantastic picture. This is great.
Horrible picture. It's disgusting. Dr. Google says that California beer has no yeast, but it sure does the job anyway. So thank you ever so much for your wonderful show and fabulous advice.
I count about 30 at least that I can see in this pan. It looks like a pie pan, and that did a great job. So putting out the beer and the oil, oil is for earwigs, beer is for slugs, and snails don't seem to go into beer, just slugs. It's a great way to monitor, to determine what your major problem was. You're finding a lot of damage in the morning when you go out there and you can't find the critters themselves. You don't know for sure whether you're dealing with earwigs or snails or slugs or some white-crowned sparrows or who knows what. First thing I look at when I'm talking to customers is the nature and size of the holes, because I can get a pretty good sense of what the mouth parts are by looking at those. Smaller holes are earwigs, bigger holes are snails and slugs and so forth. But this is a really simple way. If you put something out and there's like a film of oil in the bottom of a cake pan or bowl or beer in the case of the slugs, and you go out in the morning and you find 30 slugs in there, yeah, that pretty much tells you what your major problem was. Also, probably took care of a pretty good portion of the population as well. So very good, great picture. I promise not to post this one on the Davis Garden Show Facebook page because some people might be grossed out by it. But those of us who are gardeners, we're cheering you on.
We're cheering you, but I don't want to look at it. And having gotten that many slugs, I'd say, hey, do that again in a couple days and see, you know, you might have a lot more than you think you do.
Well, monitor the damage. I mean, we get a lot of damage all at once sometimes, and then it goes away. That would usually be a more transitory pest, like katydids or grasshoppers, which are later in the season. They come, they do damage, they're gone. By the time you see the damage, they won't be coming back. So a really important part of integrated pest management of garden pests is monitor the damage and see if it's continuing or increasing. So you've caught a lot of slugs here. It's possible you won't see much more damage, depending, of course, on where you're listening. People in coastal zones, you know, slugs are a year-round problem. Here, they tend to come and go with a dew point, with moisture. And so for us in the valley, slugs are a problem in the spring. Then as soon as we get dry north winds, they slow way down, and that you may not even have to worry about them once we get into warmer, drier weather. But if you're in coastal zones, you know that they do continue. So I would either leave that out there or refresh it, you know, just to keep an accurate count going. Keep a tally, keep a kill tally for us. Let us know.
part of your
garden journal. This week I killed 100 slugs. The other thing to watch for right now as we're warming up a little bit is fire blight on your apples and pears and all the related species. My advice on fire blight, very simply, there is no spray that home gardeners can use that works. And so you're not in the condition of orchard growers who go out and buy streptomycin and spray their orchard. You don't have that option. We just wait it out. In my opinion, pruning out fire blight during the fire blight infection season is probably not that productive. And you would probably need to clean your pruners as you go, which is not the handiest thing to do. Wait until it's all passed. Remember the temperature infection range for fire blight on apples, pears, quince. It's 55 to 82 degrees, and that's so specific I haven't forgotten it all these years later since having taken plant pathology. 55 to 82 degrees. You start getting into the mid-80s, we get dry north wind, we get up into normal temperatures here by the month of May, you're not going to get any more fire blight infection. Anytime after that, when the infection period has stopped, in my opinion, is the best time to go in and prune it out. One, it's really visible. You can see the dead areas and the healthy areas. You cut down past the dead area into a healthy area. You don't have to worry about cleaning your pruners at that point. You can do it in midsummer if you prefer. And the reason for doing that is to keep that infected wood from carrying over to next year and making the infection worse. Overall, finding resistant varieties is a great way to go with pears, because we have resistant pear varieties such as Warren, Fanstill, Moonglow. We even have a resistant Asian pear variety, Shinko, that is quite resistant. Finding resistant apple varieties is way more complicated, and I've looked at charts and charts and charts of them, and I found that the charts from one region differ from the charts from another region. And we're not really in apple country, and the apples that we sell here, none of them are on the chart as being resistant. So in that case, you just have to monitor it and prune it out after the infectious period has passed. If you're pruning it out, and many extension folks still recommend this, if you're pruning it out during the period of infection, go well below the point of infection, which is easy enough to see, cut down into green wood. Cut it, bag it. You have some wipes with you that are bleach-based or something, or isopropyl alcohol-based. You clean the pruner before you go to your next cut, and you do that one. Yes, that works up to a point. It seems like more of an effort to me, and I don't think it reduces infection all that much compared to just pruning it all out later in the season. But do as you please, whatever works for you.
And even if you have to prune out some of the stuff, a lot of fire blight, it just comes down one twig a ways down and then stops.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Yeah.
So that you don't actually have to disfigure your tree or your plant or your thing if it doesn't get all the way down to the central heater?
Depends on how susceptible the tree is. That's exactly how resistance works. I have the Warren pear, which is an outstanding European pear. Y'all want to grow pears, look for Warren. It's a really good one. And you'll see it's right next to a 20th century Asian pear, which is so susceptible to fire blight. The tree is about the same size as when I planted it. So, yeah, I mean, it's that susceptible. And fire blight will splash the 5 feet away to my Warren pear. One little point of infection within an inch, the tree has blocked it. It basically rapidly puts up a wall of cells that blocks the progression of the fire blight. So that's where its resistance comes from. And you can see, I mean, it barely even happens, 2 or 3 points on the tree, maybe during the course of an entire season. So whereas a susceptible species, it will run in, run down, kill all the flowering spurs in that zone, kill the whole branch. I've watched a loquat, which happens to be in the apple and pear family. Most people don't realize that. Very susceptible to fire blight. One of my neighbors out here in the country had one, and I watched in a high fire blight pressure year as half the tree died over a 2 week period. You could see it infecting the blossoms up high, which is usually where it gets in, ran rapidly down the branch all the way to the ground. Half the tree was dead. And of course they then just took the tree out. So in a susceptible species, it can be very problematic. If you're planting pyracantha, which is in the same group, look for the variety called Santa Cruz, which is quite resistant to fire blight. The others not only are susceptible, they become a host for fire blight in your garden for your peaches and your apples and your pears. So there's resistance in some cases. In other cases, we just avoid certain plants that get it. One side note about fire blight, don't prune your Photinia fraseri during the spring. If you have a gardening service and that nice big flush of red growth is coming on the Photinia, tell them not to prune it. I have watched as they come in right about April, which is absolute peak fire blight season, and they shear it with head shears, making all these ragged cut ends. And I've watched fire blight get in here, there, and everywhere, and it dies back very rapidly. And Photinia is in the same group as the apples and pears, and it is susceptible to fire blight. And I've watched hedges gradually die out when they're pruned heavily in the spring. If you let them grow out, enjoy that red new growth. That's what we grow Photinia for. Enjoy that red new growth all the way into the early part of the summer. Prune it then if you like, or do your major pruning in the fall, or even better, Photinia fraseri is a beautiful shrub if it's allowed to grow naturally. If you grow it naturally, you can just prune out the little bit of fire blight here and there and not have to worry about it. And you can do it when it's not infectious season. So I would love to see people planting this vastly overplanted shrub more informally, enjoying that red new growth, doing the pruning in the fall or the summer if necessary. Fall is even better. And then not enduring or dealing with as much fire blight. So let's leave our Photinias alone and be a little nicer to them.
I'm astonished that you're telling me that Photinia has fire blight. I've never seen a bit of it on mine. But then I don't prune it much. I don't prune at all. The only time I prune is if I'm getting in there to work in the garden and something's poking me in the face, well, I'll take that branch back to the, you know, a little bit. Or I'll take down the lowest branches so I can get under it better to deal with whatever's under it. But I got to tell you, it's a gorgeous bush. It doesn't have that covering of red like you see in so many places. Sure. What it is a beautiful soft green color. And then in the spring, there are these little, it looks like little candle tips. Yeah. The tip of each of the twigs gets those red leaves on it, but the rest of it is green. So it's green with these little red leaf ornaments. It's very pretty.
It's a very nice shrub. It also gets to about 15 feet. And so oftentimes, one of the biggest mistakes with Photinia is planting it where it has to be pruned. Also, pretty much anywhere Photinia would grow, the very closely related Toyon will also grow and gets just about as big. Question from Gaina, and I think we've talked about this a while back, but it's certainly ongoing here. They were driving around in the countryside and seeing just amazing number of orchards being ripped out locally here in Yolo and Solano counties, and what is up with that? And it's also came up from a customer who was wondering, is there something we should be concerned about? In other words, are they taking these out because of a disease or a pest problem, or is it just something else that's going on? So yes, if you're driving around Yolo and Solano counties right now, an amazing number of seemingly healthy walnut orchards, and in some cases older almond orchards, are being torn out. The joke right now is the biggest growth industry in the farming agriculture sector is orchard removal. In fact, you'll see those signs posted all around the countryside, orchard removal, call this number. It is pretty amazing to watch a couple hundred acres of trees disappear in less than a week. They are pushing them over, pulling them up, chipping them in most cases. A few of them were burned on, you know, piled up and burned, but most of them they're chipping, sending the chips away to cogeneration plants and places like that, and converting the land back to row crop, which is an interesting fact because orchard land at least was worth about three times per acre what row crop land was worth. Why is this happening? Well, first of all, a little background. There's more than 2 million acres of almonds and walnuts in California. Yep, that's just the two together. It's about 1.6 million acres of almonds and about 420,000 acres of almonds. The walnuts are what are really coming out. Just in the last year, they count the acreage changes. Walnut Advisory Board, Almond Advisory Board, 29,000 acres of walnuts have been removed in the last year in California.
29,000.
And about 6,000 acres appear to be abandoned, which is more of a problem. That is an issue. There is a disease, which we should mention, called thousand cankers disease that is hitting English walnuts and unfortunately native walnuts. And that's a bad one. It's causing some losses, but that's not the reason they're coming out. I've confirmed with two different growers that I know that the cost of production of a pound of walnuts for them is roughly 80 to 82 cents a pound. 2 years ago, they got 40 cents a pound. Last year, they got 39 cents a pound. So they're not just not breaking even. They're losing money every time they call the irrigation district or call someone to spray or mow. And after the second year where the price had dropped even lower than the previous year, they had to make a decision at the beginning of the irrigation season, the beginning of the spraying season, all that. What are you going to do? I mean, are you going to continue putting inputs into something where you're losing money when you harvest? No. So many, many acres are coming out. First, it was mostly older orchards because older orchards tend to have lower yield per acre. But I've noticed some perfectly healthy ones coming out, just being pushed over, ripped out, piled up, chipped or burned, and then they're converting them back to, at least for a year or two, into row crop. That's a lot of acreage. I mean, that's in 1 year, 29,000 acres coming out. By comparison, there were 13,000 new acres coming into production that had been planted 4 or 5 years previously. What happened was a whole combination of circumstances, but primarily trade disputes. One of our major partners for walnut purchase was China, and they got into a trade dispute, so that was one factor. And then there were other factors, cost of production and so forth, but it's just not worth it to have a walnut orchard in most cases, especially if you have any carrying cost for the land. That is to say, if you're leasing the land or have a mortgage on it or something like that. If you own it free and clear, that's a different issue. But many walnut growers just made the decision to take out their trees. In some cases, they're losing money. Almond growers, break even, below cost, above cost a little bit. That's been going on for a while. The future of the almond industry, there's more potential. In the last 25 to 30 years, since we first planted our first almonds more than 35 years ago, the crop in California went from 1 billion pounds to 3 billion pounds, and the price remained stable because they expanded the market. China buys or bought a lot of almonds. Lots of other parts of the world buy almonds. There's almonds in your breakfast cereal. There's almond milk, which didn't exist 25 years ago. There's all these products that can be made from almonds, none of which can really be made from walnuts. No one's going to make walnut milk. A different flavor profile. So almond industry, it's tough. They're not making as much money as they used to, but you know, they could see perhaps a clear future, especially if we back off on trade disputes and so on. There's also not that many places around the world that can grow almonds. For a long time, California grew 99% of the world's almond crop. Now Australia grows, I don't know, I think it's 14%, and they do sell direct to China. So there's some competition in that market. But it's a very narrow belt around the world where you have enough chilling hours, but it doesn't freeze too early to damage the blooms because they bloom in late February to early March. California is just perfect. And also, we don't have summer rainfall causing disease problems. I mean, they could grow almonds in South Carolina, but they'd have to spray the heck out of them for fungus problems. So we have had a monopoly on the world's almond supply for 100 years, and the Australians are muscling in on maybe 15% of that, and that's about it. So the almond industry has market potential, but in the case of almonds, heavy plantings in the 80s and 90s, almond orchard lasts about 25 years. So a lot of those are simply coming out as their acreage yield is declining, and that's what's happening with a lot of those. And maybe some of the growers just don't see the price potential for future yields in their older orchards. So that's primarily what you're seeing with almonds. With walnuts, it's a complete collapse of the market. And in the case of walnuts, I have never, as I said before, I've never seen as fast a changeover in tree crops as we've seen locally as what we're seeing right now with walnuts. I watched pears disappearing when we first moved here. plums were a big thing here. Cling peaches have been declining, but it's, you know, 1,000 acres here, 1,000 acres there. One of the biggest growers in walnuts, 12,000 acres, just filed for bankruptcy a few weeks ago. And their acreage, including 3,000 acres in Solano County, is going to be sold probably at a very reduced price. Hey, want to buy a walnut orchard? There's probably some real good deals out there, but you're not going to make much money on them.
If you're taking out a walnut orchard, I have always heard that walnut wood is exceptionally good wood. Are they harvesting the wood out of the trees, or are they just chipping it?
No, there's no practical way for them to do that. And this comes up all the time. Why don't they sell it for firewood? Why don't they sell it for lumber? Every orchard I've seen has been pulled up, pushed over, chipped, and that's it. They're not selling the wood. One, there's no, the firewood market is extremely soft. So that part right there. I'm sure people who mill lumber could get some real deals right now if they headed around and found some of the, you know, tied in with one of those companies that's doing the removal. But it's a big job removing an orchard. Yeah. And one neighbor around the corner with a smaller, like 5-acre thing, kind of like me, you know, it's a small farm. They cut them down 2 years ago. They're still dealing with the resprouting stumps. They're still dealing with chopping up the firewood. If you push the tree out or pull it out, you don't have any resprouting stumps. You don't really have anything to worry about. I'll be very curious over the next 3 to 5 years if any of them go back into orchards. Because people, I was talking with one of these growers. I said, well, what would you plant? He shrugged and said, I don't know. Not almonds, not walnuts. I said, how about pistachio nuts? He goes, well, are they going to be the next nut crop that goes through this cycle? A few of these have been replaced, and you can see one of these right along Interstate 80 as you drive along. They took them out, and a year later, they planted olives. They're planting high-density olives. It looks like they're putting in a vineyard. They've got a structure for them. They're putting little tiny plants in sleeves, so you can't even tell at first what they are. And they're olives for oil. And all of that, pun intended, can be done mechanically. They can prune them like a hedge. There's one right around the corner for me that's about 5 years old. It looks like a maze of olive hedges. They can prune it like a hedge. They can harvest it mechanically. There's almost no human input except driving through there with machinery. And olives, although they do water them a fair bit for good yield, they can cut way back on the watering without any adverse impact on the trees. So during drought emergencies where their irrigation is reduced, olive trees come through that way better in terms of both the health of the plant and yield than almonds or walnuts. So I don't know if we'll see a lot of orchards going into olives because they're higher input in some ways, at least initially. It's pretty high cost to plant trees on literally 5-foot centers. Is one of the ones I went out and measured olive trees on 5-foot spacing on a cordon technique that looks like a vineyard. And a lot of, you know, who's making money on all this? The nurseries that sell them the trees. So anyway, hope that answers your question. It's almost entirely economic factor, not diseases or pests that are causing these removals.
Well, I am going back to the mailbag, and we have a wonderful letter from Arash. Now, I was talking a little while ago, and I mentioned thinking how pretty that yard looked. And so he writes, "Thank you, Lois, for your compliment about our yard. Lots of work, love, and suggestions from Don went into it. The front yard is just gorgeous this time of year. I attached a photo from today for you and Don to admire. I love the Davis Garden Show. What a gorgeous photo. You know, this should be the photo that we use for today's show.
Okay.
All right. All flowers and bark. And it's just spectacular. I don't even know what all these things are. I won't try and name them, but oh my, it's pretty. All right. Now, the next one is an interesting letter. It is, why aren't my young trees doing well?
Yeah.
And this is Caitlin in Walnut Creek. Yeah. Hi, Lois and Don. I planted several young fruit trees about 5 years ago, and they've barely grown. What am I doing wrong? The trees were planted bare root and cut down to about 2.5 feet per the Dave Wilson method, though I wouldn't do that now that I listen to your show.
Well, okay, let's stop right there. There's nothing wrong with cutting them back that way. It just means you're going to have to use a vase training technique. I had a conversation with one of the extension master gardeners here in Davis about that. I recommend modified central leader. I think it gives you more options, and in my opinion, leads to a healthier tree in the long run. But if you bought your tree and they cut it back, all right, you're going to use a vase training technique that has some issues. But anyway, you'll encounter plenty of people who think it's fine, and I think it's okay, but I prefer modified central leader training.
Okay, so continuing. They only put on a few inches of growth each year, so they're still just about 3 feet tall.
Yeah.
They include an O. Henry peach, a Double Delight nectarine, and a Flavor Grenade pluot. There's also a Muir peach that never put out a branch and only managed a few leaves directly from the trunk each year. I removed that one this winter. I give them organic nitrogen fertilizer every spring, about 2 pounds of 1102 lawn fertilizer. Yep. So that, okay. Plus last year, I also gave them liquid conventional fertilizer a couple of times throughout the summer. They're on a drip irrigation system that gives each tree about 20 gallons of water per week, divided between two waterings. Yep. The irrigation tubing is located about 1 to 2 feet from the trunk of the tree. They are infill trees on my very steep orchard, already established when I moved here. The established trees grow and produce well, so it's generally a good spot for fruit trees. But my last thought are the surrounding trees just competing too much with them? The new trees are in open spots, about 8 to 10 foot trunk-to-trunk distance from the old trees. I've attached pictures. These were taken a few weeks ago, so don't worry. They're flowering now.
Yep.
In addition to my general growth questions, I was also wondering about the shape of the O. Henry peach. It had an unfortunate sunburn incident its first year, yep, and most of the tree died, except for one bud just above the graft. Is there much hope for this tree, or should I just start over? The bud grew into a strong new branch its second year, but since then, growth has stalled just like the others. Thank you so much.
Great, great pictures. So one thing that we have here is something that almost nobody in the Davis Woodland Dictionary ever deals with, which is a slope. It's just really unusual.
It's like almost 45 degrees.
It's on a hillside, which I had very good friends way back when I was still a student in horticulture whose family property was in Lafayette, and it was on a hill above Lafayette. So everything you planted was on a slope like this. And we learned something the hard way there that might be useful here, which was on the uphill side, to dig a bit of a ditch so that water would collect rather than just flowing over. Because anytime we tried to water, whether we're using drip or anything else, a lot of the water clearly within 15 or 20 minutes just went past the root zone of the new tree. It just flowed off and downhill. And so we would do this technique of taking a pickaxe or a mattock and
making half
a basin, yes, and on the uphill side, particularly, so that if you tried to do it on the downhill side, it would just slump out very quickly. But if you did it on the uphill side, pulling out some soil so that it was about a 4 to 6 inch deep rounded channel, so the water would stand in that at least briefly before flowing off and down, that was a key to success when we were trying to plant some ground covers there. And I suspect you may be dealing with a similar situation here. Also, the grass under the tree looks nice and green and healthy. Why? Because the grass under the tree is using most of the nitrogen that you've applied. So I would pull all that grass up and just go ahead and pull it and drop it right where it is, because it contains, I don't know, 1-2% nitrogen. Your grass is now a source of fertilizer. And they'll be really easy to pull right now because they're going into the flowering stage. Remember, annual grasses, as they go into their flowering stage, the roots die back. So the oat or barley or whatever you couldn't pull out in January because of how anchored and rooted it was, will pop right out of the ground now, especially right after, you know, quarter to a half inch of rain. So I would pull all that grass up, drop it right down there under the tree, so the nitrogen that's in the grass goes back into the soil for the tree. Make a little water collection channel or ditch or whatever you want to call it uphill from the tree, and perhaps increase your output. I don't know. I think you're having a problem with water getting where it needs to. But the other thing about that soil that we were dealing with with my friends in Lafayette, it wasn't really high in nutrient status. And so we would apply fertilizer pretty regularly. And I learned to apply fertilizer there when we were helping them out in the spring, late winter, early spring, like now. And the one you're using sounds great, with predominantly nitrogen. But also, we would go ahead and do a late summer, early fall feeding if we could. And that was mostly just taking the same kind of thing, broadcasting it kind of uphill, taking a hose and watering it in so that it would dissolve into the soil, then running the drip system for one cycle. Then what we learned was that the nitrogen in that situation would be taken in by the plant, even though it wasn't actively growing, it was still in leaf, and it would be absorbed and metabolized and stored, and you'd have better growth in the spring when you did a late summer or even better early fall, let's say September or early October feeding with predominantly nitrogen. Organic, conventional doesn't really matter as far as that goes. So if you prefer using the organic one, that's great. And if you do it in September, it's got plenty of time to be mineralized in the soil and become available to the tree and taken up and stored. So consider adding an early fall feeding to your schedule. Beyond that, I think you're having a problem with water distribution, but also right at the moment with the happy grasses underneath the tree stealing the nitrogen. We'll come back to another part of this in a moment.
Well, I'm thinking that if you're going to plant something new on this slope, that maybe before you plant, level off a little spot, maybe just, you know, a 3 foot wide section that you level off so that it is not still sloped. It's
my guess is
that way you can make a basin and you can plant like normal and your tree will be upright, not perpendicular to the slope of the lawn of the hill, which would be pointed out, but straight up. And then that would give it a good start.
That's hard to do. What you just described is difficult to do on a slope like this with the soil you're talking about, although I'm sure they probably did level it at the time of planting to some degree. It usually just slumps right back down with the next rainy season. So making the additional water catchment uphill makes a big difference. That's the one thing I can suggest. And again, I'm going to mention rootstocks. I have Flavor Grenade Pluot. My Flavor Grenade Pluot is on Citation rootstock. I might go ahead and take it out this year after 5 years in the ground. It is a wimpy grower on that rootstock, and I don't recommend Citation for that particular pluot. Nor in general do I like Citation rootstock for peaches and nectarines. To me, it reduces vigor, and we want vigor on those trees because it'll get them to outgrow the leaf curl problem, and it'll give, you know, it'll establish better. You know, Henry peach, I've had that kind of thing happen. The sunburn you're showing there stunting the plant, and you've got some new growth, so I don't know if I would rush to take it out, but I'd probably plant another O'Henry somewhere nearby if you have room for it, because my guess is that tree will always be a slow grower. You had enough cambium damage that it would take probably 2, 3, 4 years before it would get up to where you're happy with it. My inclination, it would be to replace it, or if you have room to stick another one in somewhere nearby. I don't take trees out if I don't have to. And so I like to watch and see, do they recover from things like this? If half the cambium has been killed, it'll be a long process of recovery. So you'd have to decide whether it's worth it to you to wait 2, 3, 4 years for that tree to have sufficient size and vigor, or whether you want to just go out and buy a nice new healthy one and replace it. It will recover probably, but if you're looking for rootstocks for peaches and nectarines, my strong preference is Lovell, L-O-V-E-L-L. Many nurseries get them on Lovell, and they're vigorous. So people think they want a semi-dwarf, they want the reduced vigor on peaches and nectarines. No, in my opinion, you want the vigor. I'm okay with Citation on apricot, plum, I guess. I mean, they're fine. They grow, they yield fine. Doesn't seem to make that big a difference. I'm not happy with it as a rootstock for a lot of things. And Flavor Grenade Pluot, I'm the third person now that's had this exact experience of the Flavor Grenade on the Citation rootstock turning out to be a very wimpy tree. And for peaches and nectarines, it wouldn't be my preference either. What your nursery can get is not really up to them. So you may have trouble. I don't want people zooming around trying to find this on that rootstock and mix and match. That isn't the way it works. We order in June for delivery in January, and it's not like we can special order one tree on one rootstock. So there are limitations to how far we can go in meeting your particular preference of a particular scion to a particular rootstock. But generally speaking, the growers look for very good rootstocks that are adapted to a wide range of conditions. And that's why Lovell has become so popular statewide. Citation is popular because it's called semi-dwarf, a term which, as emperor of the kingdom of horticulture, I plan to abolish.
So Don is the let's baby along this poor little deformed tree.
Sure, if you have room.
And I'm the, I want something that's going to be good. I'm going to have one of those. I don't have a huge place.
What room you have?
So I'm going to, take it out and put it in something else. There you
go. I was saying that a little more discreetly.
Oh, well, okay. Right. I guess I'm just not discreet. Huh?
There you go.
Okay. We are going to quickly go through this scheduling thing, and then that'll be the end of the show. Don has written this little paragraph. It says, my planting sequences go like this. This is when I start planting these out as seedlings in most cases. You can continue with most all the way into early June. We have a very long gardening season here. So in March, plant seedlings of beans, beets, carrots, potatoes, radishes. Mid to late April, plant tomatoes, basil, regular sweet corn, cucumbers, summer squash. Flowers to plant near your garden and to your vegetables can include borage, sweet alyssum, marigolds, and sunflowers. In May, plant peppers, eggplant, super sweet corn, melons, winter squash. Flowers could include cosmos, zinnia, asters, amaranth, celosia, and Thai basil. Thai basil is a flower. Never mind. In late May to June, now you get to plant watermelon, okra, extra hot peppers like
habanero, and all the super hots, the butjolokia, and these just insanely hot peppers. They really need warm soil. So I posted that a couple times on our local Facebook group and next door and places like that, because this is what's worked for me. You know, there, and I want people to understand, yeah, you know, that guy who plants a month ahead of all that, that's fine. I'm not arguing with those guys. I don't argue with old guys anymore. But my point is, this is when I've gotten best results. Our summary of this at our garden center is, for best results, we plant tomatoes in April, peppers and eggplants in May. But then they say, well, what about? Well, there's all the other things on there. So it's still pretty cold soil out there as we're broadcasting this program. April, really busy planting time, especially middle of April to the first week of May. You know, all kinds of things can go in. That's your really busy planting season here. Now, I know we've got folks listening in Appalachians and Manitoba, Canada, and other places. Push everything back the appropriate 4 to 8 weeks for your climate. I know a lot of those places, you don't plant any of that stuff until Memorial Day weekend, and that's fine. Maybe it's a little more condensed because you warm up more quickly. I don't know. I've never gardened in such a climate. And coastal denizens understand that, sure, you can plant early. You're never going to get warm enough for some of these things, okay?
Planting watermelon in San Francisco.
And habanero peppers are not likely to do real well unless you have and that's all the Chinense types. You know, the habaneros, the butjolokia, which is a hybrid, the Carolina Reaper, these just insanely hot peppers. They need heat. If you're listening in Fort Bragg or San Francisco or Berkeley, you might want to look on your enclosed patio that's got concrete all around that gets direct sun in the afternoon. Probably gets warm enough in there for some of them. Sure, you can plant earlier because you don't get as cold at night, I guess. I mean, I remember coastal gardening. You do have a longer season, but you don't have as many sunny days. So here we just wait until things have really warmed up for those. And again, that's for out in the garden. Some of you may be gardening in containers, your garden or raised beds where the soil warms up, and that soil temperature is what we're really after. This is just a guide. And the couple of distinctions in there, like regular sweet corn versus super sweet corn. Yeah, the extra sweets need warm soil. Why does it matter? Because they won't germinate evenly if you plant them when the soil is too cold. So if you're planting some of these extra sweets or sugary enhanced corn, or a lot of the white corn, and you plant them in late April, you plant the seed and you find it comes up at irregular intervals, so the plants don't grow together, so you don't get good pollination. So it actually affects the whole season if you plant those too early. But the kind of corn your grandpa grew, just fine. So you can plant some of the sweet corns early and then the super sweets later. That's kind of what I'm getting at there. You've been listening to The Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.